Welcome to everybody. Absolutely everybody. Okay. Any other announcements? So, yeah, okay. Just. All right, great, great. So for the inspiration, I heard that Doug is going to talk about radical acceptance. And that's a really important concept and one that we all will learn more today from Doug. And I'm looking forward to that. So I was thinking, so what would it be appropriate for me to share as an inspiration? And this is what I came up with. And to me, it makes sense. It's called the divine order in all things. In times of turbulence and change, I hold fast to spirit's unwavering presence. I'm grateful for the steadying rhythm beneath every experience, the consistent patterns amidst the shifting seasons, and the reliability of cycles, transformation, and renewal. I trust there is an order to all things, sometimes clear and other times unseen. May we all find grace to remain poised and calm in the face of uncertainty. Divine principles are always at work, and I know that confusion and turmoil will in time give way to clarity and understanding. My faith is grounded and steady so that life's unpredictability does not sway me. Fully present to all that is, I am comforted by the unseen order that is ever unfolding. Heeding my inner wisdom, I adjust and evolve gracefully. If I should stumble, I regain my confidence and continue forward with sure but light steps. I'm balanced, my heart is open, and the certainty of divine order brings me peace. So would you please join with the band and sing Surely the Presence.
We don't know why they said I had to move my office. We had theories. And we were told stories, but we don't know the real reason. We were confused, and I was unhappy. We would be me and my direct supervisor and friend, Eric. They would be the hospital administration. Right around the beginning of this year, administrators at the hospital where I work, people way above my pay grade, told my supervisor that I had to move to a different office. They never gave us a real explanation. I'd come to really like the office where I'd done my work since 2017. But the word came down from on high. Mike is a little crisp here. And so commenced a 5-month journey through the classic stages of grief. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. All around moving my workstation and some file boxes. Now I was going in and out of denial fairly often, especially as the powers that be, they had many things to think about aside from little old me. So several weeks would pass and I'd begin to relax, thinking they'd forgotten all about this unpleasant moving procedure. Then Eric, my friend, my supervisor, would say, "Well, I had another meeting with my boss, Megan, and she asked, has Doug moved his office yet?" This led to anger. Why are they making me do this? I'm already so busy. Don't they realize how many patients I'm taking care of? And so forth. There's a little self-pity mixed in there. Bargaining came into play. I spoke to a good friend who'd had a career, of all things, mediating conflicts among hospital personnel. How? And got advice on just the right tone to take in a meeting with the hospital head honcho. Depression also pulled me down into its black dog swamp oftener and oftener as I did my little tantrum dance, though it is hard to dance in a swamp. Finally, Eric told me if I didn't move, he was really going to get in trouble. He is a good friend, someone I care about and love working with. So we set a date, and the office move happened. I got to the stage of acceptance at last. And you know what? It really is okay. I had put a lot of time into making the former office nice. I've gotten better at doing that. I made the new office nice that much more quickly. Moving my office was fine in the end. I made it into a big deal. It was not. I'd reached the stage of acceptance at last. You want to play some lovely? Thank you. And I got paid overtime to do it. The title of this talk is Radical Acceptance. Radical, by the way, comes from the Latin word radix, meaning root. We're talking about acceptance that's deeply rooted, that springs forth from the heart. It's not submission, capitulation, resignation, or a bitter and resentful knuckling under. It's not, well, okay, fine. You're the windshield and I'm the bug.
Isn't there a song about that?
It isn't total agreement or endorsement or giving up my own opinion. It's simply acknowledging reality. A recognition that I and my point of view turn out they're not the only factors in this complex world we all co-inhabit. And that maybe, just maybe, my personal preferences need not hold sway in order for me to have moments of happiness and joy. As we heard from Ram Dass years ago, the way is easy for those who have no preferences. The original saying from the third Chinese patriarch, many, many more years ago, is this. I'll do it in English. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Let go of wanting and avoiding, and everything will be perfectly clear. But make the slightest distinction, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. Wow. In unity, heaven is seen as a state of mind. What this ancient wisdom is telling us is that through preferences, through clinging, through lack of acceptance, we're separated from heaven here on earth. Through our preferences and attachment, we're infinitely separated, infinitely, from the state of heaven. Now, of course, there certainly are parts of reality that we find unpleasant to contemplate and don't really want to accept. Our own failures may come to mind. Perhaps some of you, like me, have a catalog of catastrophes hidden deep in the basement of memory. These fiascos are part of our life experiences that are kind of cringy to think about, that we'd really rather not remember. And now we're all going to share one. No. What if I could accept my thoroughly embarrassing moments that definitely will not be discussed in today's talk with equanimity, with self-compassion, with concern for those that I affected more than for my own self-image? What if we could do that? What if acceptance of our own failings and foibles was unconditional, radical, and total? How about radical acceptance of other people? All the litterers, tailgaters, the explosives aficionados in the woods near our home, the drunk drivers, nickel and dime tyrants, petty misbehaviors, as those who truly perpetrate injustice and cruelty. Again, radical acceptance isn't some kind of support or seal of approval. It's not a validation or affirmation, but it's an acknowledgement of reality. Foolish, selfish, hardened, and even evil people exist. In fact, some version of all those qualities probably exists from time to time inside our own skins, in our brains and hearts, to be absolutely candid. Rumors of our saintliness have been exaggerated.
Speak for yourself.
Right, except for Jana, there's complete perfection. Okay, here's a good one, folks. What about accepting our own mortality? Somehow, this seems easier to think about today than it was, say, when I met Steve in 1970. Or when I was 35. But do I truly accept this reality? Or do I sort of secretly believe that the universe will make an exception in just this one instance because I'm me? Surely you can't get along without me in the world, right, God?
Bargain.
That's bargaining, yeah. I'd already been thinking about this topic of acceptance. It had really been on my mind when, don't you know it, not so long ago, Sally says to me, I heard this amazing interview on the radio with a man named Dave Evans. You have to hear it. Dave Evans was featured on the Hidden Brain radio show and podcast. And among the stories he told was one about his friend, Gary. Gary, in his early 50s, had had a stroke and was sidelined from his job as a technical writer. He came to Dave asking for advice on how he could regain his health so that he could get back to work. And Dave told Gary, I don't think you're asking the right question. Maybe the question isn't, how can you get back to work, but, and he knew Gary really well, given your medical history and a family pattern of men having strokes and dying in their 50s in your family, well, lots of people die in their 50s, and you might be one of them. If that's the case, how can you do this as well as you can? So we had a long conversation about that. The interviewer then made the point that it must have been difficult to say something like this, something a friend is not supposed to say. Dave replied, "This is where we make the distinction between being nice and being loving. Are you trying to be nice to somebody, or are you trying to love them?" I wasn't trying to be unkind, but if it's true that he's going to die of a stroke, which he did about 4 strokes later, then either he's going to do that and be blindsided by it and terrified at the moment of death and leave his family in some despair about his final days, or he's got a little more time to do this well. So what's the kindest thing I can do? The kindest thing I can do is give him a shot at the invitation to actually find the meaning and the joy that are available. We had that conversation, and he received it reasonably well. I bumped into his wife in the supermarket about 3 weeks later, and she walks up to me and she goes, "What was it you said to Gary?" And I thought, oh man, this is going to go badly. And I said, "Well, this is what I said." And she said, "It made all the difference in the world. He's a changed man. He's finally at peace. It was amazing. Thank you." And she burst into tears, which I'm very close to doing.
That's why we love you.
I thought it was for lifting heavy things, but okay.
I keep him in a case with a hammer.
Break.
Some heavy
things. Break glass.
Dave went on in this interview to talk about a time his own wife, Claudia, hadn't been able to shake a cold she'd picked up. She was coughing all the time, so we went into the clinic, and they said, "Oh, there's more going on here." They sent us to the ER, and there they pumped out 1.5 liters of fluid from her lungs and said, "We're going to send this over to the lab." And when the results came back, the news was that she had terminal cancer that had metastasized, and she had from 6 to 24 months to live. She lived 9 months. Well, we knew things weren't good, but we didn't know it was fatal. It hit us very hard. We said, "We've got to receive this." We didn't tell anybody. We sat on it privately for about 8 days, with the idea being let it sink in and then decide what's the story. By the way, let's just consider the consciousness of that. When something happens, we have a choice in what story we tell ourselves and our world about it. And this couple said essentially, "Let's go on a retreat and decide what the story will be about this major event in our lives." At the end of the week, Claudia said, the one-liner is, "I'm dying. It's sad, but not tragic." It's sad, but not tragic. You see that one? I love that one. She was 69 at the time, had lived a very full life. There was really nothing left on our bucket list, Dave said, nothing we needed to do. Lots we wanted to do. Hadn't even begun to be retired people, but nonetheless, no regrets. And she chose to live into her final months saying, sooner than I had in mind. But let's be honest, this is just sad, not tragic. Let's make the most of the time. And that was probably one of the most intense and actually one of the most wonderful periods of my life. The reason it was different for us was simply this acceptance. We deferred all the what's next and why me? Because frankly, none of that matters. What was true was she was going to die. So our choices were to be present to that or to be absent to that. Most people who are in denial and resistance just make it harder and more painful. We were just trying to do this thing as easily as we possibly could. The interviewer pointed out that people generally go through denial and anger and bargaining and depression before getting to acceptance. But what Dave and Claudia did was cut out those first four steps and just get to the last one. And Dave said, yes, we had really worked at being good acceptors for a long time. He profiled some of the hard lessons he and Claudia had already lived through, saying, we've been around a lot of things not of our choosing. My father killed himself when I was 9. So reality was something we had been in school with before. And that allowed us to go to acceptance first. The long, slow path to it doesn't look attractive to me. Yesterday was the 82nd anniversary of D-Day. And in considering acceptance, one thing that came to my mind was how, despite years of careful planning, no one truly knew how that operation would go. I feel the lesson of acceptance is manifest in what Dwight Eisenhower wrote prior to the invasion in case of failure. He prepared 2 short speeches in case of success, in case of failure. For failure, he wrote, our landings in the Cherbourg Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone.
They don't make them like that anymore.
This is a radical acceptance of responsibility. I don't know why, it just chokes me up, because we don't have it now, right? It's at a high leadership level, a quality notably lacking in today's world to a great extent. In writing about radical acceptance, I've been drawn to illustrate my tale with some of the most advanced graduate level work there is in that endeavor. Acceptance of our impermanence, of the fleeting nature of our lives. In a 13.8 billion year old universe, our lifespans are as mayflies. Right? If the universe were, instead of 13.8 billion, 100 years long, our lifespans, if you lived to a full century, would be like 13 seconds. Of that 100 years. I did the math. We live only some fleeting few years while our imagination encompasses eons. And in that gap, there dwells a grief. If your hearts can take it, I want to share one further story of how acceptance was indeed a challenge in the face of loss. This account comes from my old friend and Steve's old friend, Hal, whom I met in 1968. He writes, "A friend was married to a wonderful woman who, soon after he introduced her to me, was diagnosed with both congestive heart failure and cancer. She soon died in the ICU. A few years later, my friend met, fell in love with, and married another wonderful woman. They had been married only a few years when she too was diagnosed with cancer. After struggling with the illness and the treatment she was receiving, which was very, very hard on her, she, as a person of deep faith, finally told my friend she'd had enough and wanted to stop treatment. She died not long after the treatment was ended. A few months after her funeral, my friend told me about a conversation he'd had with God, with the Holy Spirit. He told me that in a moment when he was in the throes of his grief, he felt intense anger at God, threw his hands in the air and screamed, 'What is it you want from me?' My friend said that almost immediately he heard the gentle and soothing voice of God, of the Holy Spirit, say to him, 'I want you to love the person I put in front of you. Love the person I put in front of you.' My friend has embraced that ever since. The songwriter Bruce Cockburn, who has been a touchstone and model for us as musicians, once wrote a song for friends who had lost a baby to sudden infant death syndrome. In the lyric, he urges them in the face of their grief to open their hearts and grow with what life sends. May we learn with open hearts to grow with what life sends. In unconditional acceptance, in surrender to God and in God's embrace. May we learn to simply love the person God puts in front of us. May we, with God's grace, view with radical acceptance ourselves and all we encounter as pilgrims on the road to Canaan, all seeking love, truly on a journey home.